The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We've got three senators, five governors, one neurosurgeon, and two captains of industry. By name, you've got Trump, Fiorina, Carson, Bush, Walker, Kasich, Christie, Huckabee, Rubio, Paul Cruz.
Thank you, Governor.
This is why people are upset.
We're going to get to many of these issues. We're still in the first block, believe it or not.
The GOP debaters, who put in a full 3 hours last night at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California, did their work. There was some nastiness.
And Mr. Trump, we don't need an apprentice in the White House. We need someone who can actually get the job done. And you talked about business.
Well, in Wisconsin,
Let me finish.
You're losing $2.2 billion right now.
I would do so
much better than that.
Donald Trump, he wanted casino gambling in Florida. Yes, you did.
Totally false.
You wanted it, and you didn't get it.
I promise, during and after.
There was some typical head for the lifeboats America hyperbole.
We are eviscerating our military, and we have a president that is more respectful to the Ayatollah in Iran than he is to the Prime Minister of Israel.
You're telling me that you cannot make an accommodation for an elected Democrat county clerk from Rowan County, Kentucky? What else is it other than the criminalization of her faith and the exaltation of the faith of everyone else who might be a Fort Hood shooter or a detainee at Gitmo?
There was the bedside manner of Ben Carson responding to a question about vaccines and autism.
The fact of the matter is, we have extremely well-documented proof that there's no autism associated with vaccinations. But it is true that we are probably giving way too many in too short a period of time.
And there was plenty of talk of public enemy number one, who sits in the White House until 2017.
You know, Obama's committed to his principles, his liberal principles. He will fight for them. He says, I will veto any budget that doesn't fund Planned Parenthood, and Republicans surrender. We need to stop surrendering and start standing for our principles.
Thank you, Senator.
And last but very much not least, there was Carly, whose recent dust-ups with Donald Trump put her in an unusual kind of spotlight last night. She delivered many substantive moments in the debate, but here's Carly Fiorina's clever version of You're So Vain, following a question about Trump from CNN's Jake Tapper.
Last week in Rolling Stone magazine, Donald Trump said the following about you, quote, look at that face. Would anyone vote for that? Can you imagine that, the face of our next president? Mr. Trump later said he was talking about your persona, not your appearance. Please feel free to respond what you think about his persona.
You know, it's interesting to me. Mr. Trump said that he heard Mr. Bush very clearly and what Mr. Bush said. I think women all over this country heard very clearly what Mr. Trump said.
Nice, Carly. But was this debate just about you? The voters, ratings, and pollsters will have some conclusions about all that very soon. What about your thoughts on the debate last night? You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. We reached out to a Republican voice in Tallahassee, Florida, Chelsea Henry, attorney and president of the Republican Diversity Coalition. She gave us a very candid impression of what she liked in the debate, what she didn't like, and where she thinks the GOP field needs to go.
Well, Trump started out as normal Trump. You know, I call it the Trump style, where he just went in and was insulting people. And so for me, that is not what I desire in our next commander in chief, especially with the issues that face America. And so I think what I saw and what I was very impressed with was the debate from Carly.
We, the United States of America, will make it as difficult as possible to move money around the global financial system. We can do that. We don't need anyone's cooperation to do it. And every ally and every adversary we have in this world will know that the United States of America is back in the leadership business.
Carly came in. She fought her way to that stage. She said, I deserve to be there. She was able to stand there. She stood her own. She had the fastest statistics. And I love the fact that she didn't give us any Trump answers. When you're running for a position, especially the president of the United States of America, you should be having your team looking into everything. And so Carly did great. I'm here in Florida. I'm a Florida girl. And so I was extremely proud of Governor Jeb Bush. He stood up for his wife. He stood up for his brother. But most importantly, he stood up and said, I am my own man. No matter what my last name may be, I am my own man. I have platforms that I want to share with the American people to let them know why I will make a great president. Marco Rubio was awesome. You know, I wasn't sure of what his debate performance was going to be, but towards the end, I can tell you he came in and he showed up and he showed the American people that during his time in Senate, he's learned about the issues that affect us.
Well, he had some interesting things to say about Russia that I think surprised me. I was surprised by Kasich's lack of impact, it seemed to me. What'd you think of Christie?
I think Christie did a good job of trying to steer the message and trying to get back in the conversation, because we all have to be honest. There were 11 people on that stage. The debate did go for 3 hours, so it did give people the candidates ample time to talk. However, Christie would bring the message back, but I also think that he did a good job of talking about the middle class and talking to them, you know, bringing it back down to the level that many Americans want to hear.
All right, and Ben Carson, in the shadows, what did you think?
Ben Carson, Dr. Carson, I think that he was himself. When you put him on a stage with people who are very combative, I think that his persona allows people to see someone who's calm. It allows people to see him as someone who thinks through his answers. And so he brings a different dynamic to the table when we look at the diversity of the candidates.
Let me shift to Act Two here.
We are eviscerating our military.
When they issued this sort of massive attack against us,
we have what Jefferson said was judicial tyranny.
I would begin rebuilding the missile defense program in Poland.
Making the Obama administration's the world's leading financier of radical Islamic terrorism.
I would conduct regular, aggressive military exercises in the Baltic states.
The Russians will begin to fly combat missions in that region.
I'd probably send a few thousand more troops into Germany.
This is really about the survival of Western civilization.
It seemed like everybody was telling America that this is a moment of extreme crisis in the country, that President Obama has stolen our future and that we have to get it back. Is that going to play? I mean, do Americans really think that everything's going to hell? And is that going to work for the GOP?
It will work for the base. At the very most, because when you look at the conservative base, they are concerned about issues that have been taken up in the last 7 years. So they're concerned about how the president has interacted with foreign diplomats. They are concerned about health care. They are concerned about the economic climate of America. These are things that the president and his administration have had an impact on. What's going to happen with America? That is really going to be left in the hands of the next president. And there are things that next president is going to have to do, because I truly believe we're in a crossroads. You know, an issue that's very important to me is criminal justice reform. And I'm a part of an organization called the 2020 Leaders of America. And it's a bipartisan collective of individuals, mayors, city councilmen, attorneys, etc. And we're bringing this issue to the forefront because the facts and the statistics show that the African-American and minority communities are disproportionately affected through the criminal justice system.
And well, Chelsea, let me interrupt you there. I mean, you must have been really disappointed because that really didn't come up last night.
I think Rand Paul did a good job of bringing it into the conversation, especially when he was talking about the war on drugs.
I think that the war on drugs has had a racial outcome and really has been something that's really damaged our inner cities. Not only do the drugs damage them, we damage them again by incarcerating them and then preventing them from getting employment over time.
When we look at history, it was the Clintons that pushed those harsher sentencing reforms, which has led to more African Americans being put into prison. And so, yes, I wish there was a greater conversation about criminal justice reform. I wish there was a greater conversation about exactly what these candidates are going to do to spur job creation. And so those are different things that didn't come out.
Finally, have these debates and the presence of these outliers like Carson and Trump changed the process? We used to always think it's all about Iowa and New Hampshire. It's not so much about Iowa and New Hampshire all of a sudden. That may change. What's your assessment of how unpredictable this campaign has suddenly become?
Mr. Trump, the Trump style is a style of entertainment. He says things that invokes emotion, that invokes people to either love him or hate him. Let's be honest. Do we want someone who's going to insult another American, just in general, in the tone and manner in which he does? So he's changed up the way that we've seen this political process. Dr. Carson has done a great job of just being himself. He's been clear. Listen, I haven't ran for office before. I'm not trying to say that I have all this experience, but I am trying to let you know that I have plans and ideas for America. And so just that candidness and that honesty to be himself, to stay himself throughout the process, it has changed things up a little bit.
It's kind of a brave new world then before we go. I mean, the last 8 years have been pretty angry in terms of GOP politics, but it hasn't been really entertaining. Entertainment might just be the new idea.
It may be the new idea, but I don't think that's the idea that's going to get that's going to decrease unemployment. I don't think that's going to be the idea that's going to help students who tend to be trapped by their zip codes and underperforming schools. It's not going to help those who are trapped in a criminal justice system that needs reform. It's not going to help people who are trying to go to college, but their college tuition continues to increase. They realize that they have to pay between 4% and 7% on interest on their loans. That grander, that Trump style doesn't relate to the everyday issues. I will vote for a president that is going to allow me, when I go home at night and sit at my kitchen table, to not be stressed about how they're representing America and what they're doing for Americans like myself.
Chelsea Henry is an attorney and president of the Republican Diversity Coalition. She spoke with us from WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida. In a moment, the discussion of why the migrant crisis in Europe represents a denial of history by some European nations and is actually a crisis the international community is prepared for, at least on paper. But with the border between Syria and Hungary now closed, Croatians are welcoming Syrian refugees into their territory. But there is a complication. An estimated 50,000 landmines buried beneath Croatian soil, covering nearly 200,000 square miles. Miljenko Vastaric is assistant director of Croatia's Mine Action Center. He says his country has been actively dealing with the mines left over from the Balkan Wars decades ago and is welcoming the migrants and refugees with open, cautious arms.
The mine problem in Croatia, the hazards are minimalized because the all suspected area in Croatia is marked with the warning signs. There is more than 12,000 warning signs across all our suspected hazards areas. So they are visible, and whoever will go to unmarked or not regular border crossing, they will see these warning signs and they will avoid this area.
Is Croatia actively welcoming migrants that the Hungarian government seems to be shunning at this point?
Well, currently all these migrants are coming, turning from Serbian-Hungarian border to Croatia. And from this morning, there are more than 6,000 migrants came to Croatia. The multi-sectoral crisis committee is established this morning by the government. They are taking care of these migrants. They are organizing their trip to the centers where they will be registered. In accordance with the regulations, they will be continuing to Europe or staying here in Croatia. We'll see.
How can you be sure that they won't be victims of the estimated 50,000 landmines?
In the past 3 years, so from 2012, We didn't have civilians among the mine victims, so there were no mine incident involving civilians because, as I said, this is the job of the CROMAC. We are responsible for managing this mine suspected area, for demining activities, and also for marking of this area and for the education to inform people about the area that are dangerous. So we have produced the map that you can find on the internet. Of course, the migrants don't have approach to the internet, but all these people that are responsible for these activities on the border, they will give them leaflets with the messages, with the pictures of this warning sign. So if they will go illegal way through Croatia, these marks, these tables are universal. I'm quite sure that most of them have seen them in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Iraq, where they are coming from.
You make a good point that certainly the migrants are familiar with mines from the conflict zones that they're coming from. But, you know, almost 200,000 square miles in Croatia, that's mind. And in the last 20 years, less than 200 people have died, even though 300 have been injured. You've had success. But if the situation becomes more chaotic, can you be assured that the signs and the maps and the precautions that you've already taken will work?
Well, I'm quite sure it will work because currently we are finishing with some demining activities in the border area. In the next few weeks, we'll be completely cleared and safe for all the citizens of Croatia. That's also for migrants that will go to this area.
How much does this crisis remind you of those terrible times back in the 80s and 90s during the Balkan Wars when there was so much chaos and so many people with no place to go moving across borders where they weren't welcomed?
Well, yeah, it returned us back some 25 years ago when there was almost 500,000 refugees in Croatia. So a majority of the people in Croatia are sympathizing with these people because most of them were in the same situation during the war. And we would help them as much as we can. And all the institutions are working on this to make their life easier. If somebody will decide to stay in Croatia, everything is again prepared for them. So we'll see what will happen in the next few days.
A welcoming voice from Zagreb, Croatia. Miljenko Vaštarić is assistant director of CROMAC, Croatia's Mine Action Center. His main priority is protecting migrants from the 50,000 landmines buried beneath Croatian soil since the Bosnian wars of the last 20 years. Miljenko, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The question for the world right now is, why is this chaos even happening?
Stay 5 days in the street, no foods, no anything. Now I'm coming here, I will go outside the Greek.
The voice of a refugee from Syria stranded in Greece right now with no hope. The brutal Syrian civil war may not have an easy solution, but part of the outrage over the refugee crisis in Europe right now is that there should not be a crisis. The procedures and laws for handling exactly this kind of crisis already exists. The United Nations first ratified the Convention on Refugees back in 1951 with the rules for how to handle moving populations. It was in the wake of World War II. James Hathaway is a professor of law and director of the Refugee and Asylum Law Program at the University of Michigan. He says the UN Refugee Convention could be helping right now. And for European nations to be ignoring it, Hathaway says, amounts to denying a century of their own history.
We really didn't have any need for asylum until about 100 years ago, because it was only roughly 100 years ago that states of the Western European sphere began to erect border controls. And so you didn't need a trump card on border controls when there were few, if any, border controls. By the early 20th century, we did have this theory, at least, that only those that we chose were entitled to cross a border. This is all tied up with the idea of the nation state, that our security was better ensured by having the people living here being of a common ethnic stock. Along came the Bolshevik Revolution, a slightly inconvenient phenomenon for those who thought border control ought to be sacrosanct. We had 1.5 million people fleeing what became the Soviet Union scattered around Europe. Ironically, there is an historical echo to what we're seeing right now. The Soviet Union denationalized them all, stripped them of their citizenship. They were left stranded around Europe, couldn't work, couldn't educate their kids, and became a social problem. And so the world community came together and said, when people actually need to flee, when they have to vote with their feet, they will do that. It is in our interest to regularize their status, to give them a chance to become self-sufficient, indeed to contribute to us, because to do that is not only a dignified response, but it's actually a very intelligent response. And indeed, history has proved that right. Refugees have been among the greatest contributors to the societies to which they've traveled. What we're missing now is a way routinely to operationalize that commitment again.
How is this crisis in Europe right now with the migrants from the Middle East testing international law on this subject?
Well, it's testing it in a number of ways. I think most fundamentally, the idea of international refugee law is that when a person either claims to be a refugee or is part of a group that you can readily see are made up of refugees, and clearly the Syrians and the Afghans that make up most of the current movement fit that bill, it's absolutely impermissible to do anything to push them back away from your borders, which, for example, is exactly what Hungary is doing right now. This is something that should have been condemned loudly and forcefully by the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. It hasn't been condemned as forcefully as it should have been. And indeed, ironically, it's been up to the German chancellor and the president of the European Commission to say just how wrongful this behavior is and to try to organize a fix, at least, you know, to deal with those who are arriving now and hopefully for the future.
Putting aside the details of the crisis for a moment, is this whole situation with disputes between Hungary and the rest of the European Union another example of how weak the European Union is being revealed to be?
I don't think it's so much about weakness as it is, at least in the asylum context, about Europe having made a very fundamental mistake some years ago. They originated a rule that is termed the Dublin Regulation Rule, which says that any refugee arriving in Europe must stay literally in the first country in which he or she sets foot. And what that has done is to put enormous strains on countries like Greece and Hungary and others that are on the front lines. And it's effectively insulated the rich countries like, you know, Germany and others from the overwhelming share of the refugee responsibility. What we're seeing now for the first time is the president of the European Commission actually saying that rule does not work. It makes no sense. That accidents of geography shouldn't determine how the responsibility to protect people is shared out. And I think this is a wonderful moment. In truth, it's a moment that I'm hoping will promote us to rethink the way we do refugee law on the global level, where, you know, we have 85% of the world's refugees in the world's poorest countries getting essentially nothing but the occasional bits of charity from the rest of us. This is not the way the system was ever meant to work, and it's high time that we set about getting a fix to the system.
How was it meant to work? What are the traditions that form the basis of how we think about asylum law?
Well, it's a great question, John, because the convention simply says, here's the definition of who is a refugee, and here are the rights that refugees get, rights to work, education, mobility, etc. The drafters took 3.5 years to come up with this treaty, and it obviously was a hard slog. And in the end, they inserted into the preamble of the treaty, so it's not formally binding, but it expresses their intentions that this system should be operationalized in a way that equalized the burdens and responsibilities of states. Occasionally, we've done that. You may recall, for example, back in the 1970s when the Indochinese boat people crisis occurred and people were leaving Vietnam and ending up in places like Malaysia and Hong Kong and elsewhere. The rest of the world did come together and share out the responsibility to protect those refugees, and they moved around the world in ways that equalized the burdens of reception states. We did the same thing in Central America under a program called SEREFCA and in Africa under a program called ICARA. So what I've proposed is that we learn the lessons of those actually really positive experiences where rather than waiting to see where people end up and trying ex post facto to try to fix things, which is what Europe is trying to do now. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, shopping for insurance when the house is already on fire. It's not a good way to work. What we need is to operationalize the preamble to the treaty with quotas for both sharing human responsibility and financial burdens that a UN agency can call on when a crisis occurs in an orderly, cost-effective way. There's no need to do what we're doing now, and I think there's every reason to rethink our approach given the horrors of what we've seen over the last few weeks in Europe.
James Hathaway is a professor of law and director of the Refugee and Asylum Law Program at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like Russian, retirement planning, and rock climbing. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Everyone in the latest GOP debate wanted to talk about America in decline under President Obama last night. Governor Christie of New Jersey insisted the campaign was about how voters feel right now.
For the 55-year-old construction worker out in that audience tonight who doesn't have a job, who can't fund his child's education, I got to tell you the truth. They could care less about your careers. They care about theirs. Let's start talking about that on this stage and stop playing the games.
This very American rhetorical device in politics would have us all believe that the strength of our nation is somehow bound to how we all feel about ourselves. How do you feel about yourself? This pop hit by Haley Steinfeld is a credible reminder of how much our culture measures itself in selfies, emotional selfies, literal selfies, psychological selfies. It's something that makes University of Virginia English professor Mark Edmondson worried about our times. In his new book, Self and Soul, A Defense of Ideals, Edmondson reaches back to classical and religious notions of common ideals that go beyond the self. Where have those ideals gone, he asks. The self is seductive, but can be a dead end.
The suspicion of self is that it gets too much into desire, too much into I, me, and mine, and that it traps us in the world of wanting and success and consumption and all that sort of stuff, whereas soul, I think, can deliver us from that kind of world.
Do you think that there are opportunities in our contemporary life for soul to exist alongside self, or does self have to be pushed back in some way? I mean, you listen to the news and the din of popular narcissistic culture. It's almost hard to see where soul goes. There's so much self there.
You're exactly right. Well, soul I associate with three kinds of pursuits: pursuit of courage, pursuit of wisdom, and the pursuit of compassion. In the book, I talk about people whose lives have been completely given over to these soul ideals. So I talk about Jesus and the Buddha in terms of compassion. I talk about Achilles and Hector in terms of courage. And in terms of thought, I talk about Plato and Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I take those people, by and large, to have devoted themselves just about completely to soul values. I think the rest of us can dispose of ourselves a little bit more moderately, and we may embrace some of these ideals, but there's also going to be room for self, if only because we need some protection.
How can one be an Emerson in modern life without being a, you know, well-to-do New Englander who's got plenty of time on his hands?
Well, you're right about Emerson. He was a well-to-do New Englander with time on his hands. But he's also a hard worker. He made a lot of money going around the country lecturing, and he sold those essays for money. But I think anybody who is devoted to following an Emersonian path has got a serious problem on his hands, or her hands. Got to mark out the time to do the reading and do the work. And that sometimes means working part-time and making ends meet. My son right now, my older son, is a bike mechanic for the most part, and he's also a novelist. My younger son teaches music lessons, and he also plays guitar and writes songs. So they're kind of in the self world and the soul world and trying to make it work.
In our politics, we seem to mistrust idealists and prefer pragmatists. Is that a sign that we've abandoned the classics and the classic notions of ideals?
I think it is. When you think about John F. Kennedy's great line, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I think that any politician who said that line now, unless he was quoting Kennedy or something, would be dismissed out of hand as somebody who was far too idealistic. But I do think also that our best politicians try to create a society where ideals are possible for the people who live there. It's possible to be compassionate. It's possible to be brave and fight in a just war. It's possible to be an intellectual or a scientist and have one's work used in ways that are productive. So I think politics does have a place. Whether anybody in the current political theater is trying to make that place for ideals, I think an open question.
What would Achilles say about the sacrifices of Iraq and Afghanistan? We call virtually everyone who served in these wars heroes, yet we have difficulty articulating what the mission was even to this day, including presidents. What would Achilles say?
I think what Achilles would say is that any man or woman who goes into battle and is willing to risk his life or hers and is trying to be the best soldier that he can be or she can be is a hero. Now, Hector, on the other hand, I think would say it only really counts as heroism if the war is just or if you can explain it to yourself as being a just war. And then you risk your life in behalf of your country because you know that that kind of risk is worthwhile. So two different ideals come out of the Iliad, Hector and Achilles.
In the current discussion of race in America right now, in the wake of what's happened in Ferguson and other places, many very profound, mostly African-American writers have described America as a place devoid of ideals, and that the quicker that's recognized, the more we'll come to a shared experience about race. And some writers have said ideals have actually been used to oppress African-Americans. The American dream idea, the we are free idea, is actually a lie that conceals so much crime afflicted on such people. Does America have to get past its mythology of ideals to get to the real ideals that democracy and the framers maybe had in mind back in 1776?
Yeah, I've been very impressed at the way African Americans have talked about these, particularly somebody like Cornel West, who seems to me less interested in the changing of laws and the modification of standards, though he is interested in that, but who's very interested in, you know, Christian love and reconciliation and the acceptance of one person by another. Even when Cornel West is in a terrible fight with somebody, he always calls them brother or sister, and he has that sense of Christian unity and wholeness, which, although I'm not a Christian, I don't believe in a transcendent God, I do respect a great deal. And after these horrifying events, many African Americans step forward, and they're not always talking about changing the laws, they're talking about changing hearts. And changing hearts is in tune with the America that, you know, embraced immigration, that thinks of us all as equals, and thinks of us also as engaged in this enormous and very compelling experiment, which is the experiment of creating the world's first really functioning multiracial democracy. And if we can do that, you know, I think it's going to have to be done by love and care rather than exclusively by laws. And I think that's what a lot of the black thinkers and writers are getting at.
Are you an idealist?
Sure. I am. I mean, the thing that is, I guess, most important, or a most important thing in my life, is using what education I've had. And I've had a very good, been fortunate enough to have a terrific education with spectacularly good teachers. And now I teach at the University of Virginia, a wonderful place. But I want to use what I've learned there to help other people move in the direction of what I at least perceive to be truth. Not to say I don't have a side of self. You know, I have two sons. I have a family. I have a house to pay the mortgage on. And as of today, I have a Volvo with 100,000 miles on it and a badly leaking oil system. So I live in self, too, you know. But I try to get that soul thing going when I can.
Good luck with the Volvo.
Oh, thanks. Still under warranty.
Oh, that's good to know. Mark Edmondson, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Mark Edmondson is University of Virginia professor of English and author of Self and Soul, A Defense of Ideals. Here's something to take with you today. You know, there's this plan to put a woman on the $10 bill. Candidates were asked about that in the weary last moments of last night's debate. Here's Jeb Bush's off-the-top-of-his-head's answer.
I would go with Ronald Reagan's partner, Margaret Thatcher. Probably illegal, but what the heck, since it's not going to happen.
Excuse me, British Margaret Thatcher on U.S. money will make America great again? Why not put Catherine the Great on the 20, Eva Perón on the 5, and Angela Merkel on the 1? Excuse me? Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.